Dr. David Weindorf that comes from Texas Tech University to talk to us and give us his perspective of soil science around the globe, the issues, intervention, and opportunities.
Thank you, Veronica, and thank you all for having me today. It's a pleasure to speak with you and talk a little bit about a very important issue, as we've heard a lot already this afternoon about soil degradation and how this influences different ecosystem dynamics. And so I've had the opportunity over the last decade or so to go around the world in many different places, and I want to show you some of those issues that we've talked about, illustrate those a little bit, and then draw some common strings between those. Just give you a little background on this. Of course, today, global food production is of paramount importance. We have 7.2 billion people, and we have people all over the world that are struggling for food. We're very blessed in the United States to be a major food producer in the Great Plains, but areas in this hemisphere, in Haiti, you know, where we have really rampant problems with food security. Other developing countries in the world, whether they're in Africa or other parts of the world, we have to recognize those. We have the rise of affluent countries coming up in the world, China, India, Brazil. These are new powers that are going to be emerging over the next 20 years or so. As you look at some of the emerging agricultural production themes, you see lots of issues of animal health, biodiversity, aquaculture, family farming, organic farming, pollinators and bees. This has been something that's been in the news a lot lately, the bee die-off, seeds, seed banks, urban agriculture. There are social issues that play into this as well, gender equity issues, health and disease, hunger, the rights of indigenous people, the right to food, school nutrition programs, and health. All of these approaches, in my mind, harken back to soil. You think about the issues that we have today, and so many of those issues that we fight about politically or socially or economically, they harken back to soil, and utilizing soils as a natural resource. So who are some of the major players? Obviously, I couldn't list all of them here, but of course, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Our previous speaker just spoke about the work of the European Union. CICERO, a group out of Australia, they're their national science agency working with soil, water, natural resources. The Institute of Soil Sciences, Chinese Academy of Sciences out of Nanjing. The International Union of Soil Sciences, and of course, closer to home here in the U.S., the Natural Resources Conservation Service. And you'll see that one of their emergent themes where they placed a lot of emphasis on is soil health. And that's something that is a national priority, and rightly so. It involves all of us. Well, I want to walk you around the world, and I want to give you some examples of some of these different impacted areas and draw some commonalities between different areas that I've been to. So let's go to Haiti first. 9.7 million people. They have a GDP of around $1,200 compared to that of the U.S. of $52,000, one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. This is what it looked like after the 2010 earthquake, but I'll tell you there are many parts of Haiti that look like that today. Rampant poverty, malnutrition, lack of education, lack of resources, poor infrastructure. This is a 45-minute flight out of Miami. So this is just off the coast of the United States. And it seems like it's a world away, but it's really not. Urban squalor have led many people to move to the countryside, but this has placed a stronger burden on the rural resources that are out there. Look at those really deep, lush soils there for producing corn, right? No, they don't have that at all. They have thin, rocky, nutrient-poor soils that are washed away every time there's a hurricane that churns through the Caribbean. You can look at this on a satellite image and clearly see the border between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. The Dominican Republic has chosen not to cut down their trees. And in Haiti, there are virtually no trees left in the country. And the reason for that is the ultimate catch-22. You know, you've got the quest for any fuel source available, people scouring the land, and they cut down the trees that are there to make charcoal to cook their food. And so in creating that charcoal, they're left behind with these thin, rocky soils that are highly erosive. And I've asked farmers about this when I've been down there. Don't you know that you're compromising your future when you cut those trees down? You need to hold that soil in place with the roots. And they say, yes, Dr. Weindorf, I know about that, but I'm worried about feeding my family tonight. So how do we go about addressing issues like that? Again, virtually no trees. You see, they're trying to grow corn in these types of areas on a 30% slope with rocks everywhere. Where do we start in Haiti? First of all, there's no soil survey data available anywhere in the country. None. So how do you even start to manage the resources that you have until you know what you have or know what you don't have? They have limited to no access to commercial fertilizer. Even if it is available, it's expensive. They can't afford to buy it. There's no national plan for soil conservation or environmental protection. So we have to start thinking outside the box. Maybe start with animal manure sources. Going there and instead of letting the animals just kind of roam all over the place, let's start to confine some of those animals and collect the manure and utilize that as a nutrient stream. Of course, high in phosphorus. Utilize other existing waste streams that they have, vegetable scraps and waste, whether this is, you know, leftover materials or scraps from their dinner, or green waste, leaves that can be collected and composted. How about human waste sources? You know, here in the United States, that would have a real ick factor associated with it, but when your livelihood depends on it, you see them building composting pit toilets here. They'll actually encourage the villagers there to utilize that pit toilet. Then they'll have somebody scoop all of that manure out and apply that back across the soil as a nutrient source. Not only does this provide a nutrient source, but it also cleans the water, because oftentimes you'll find people relieving themselves in the river or washing in the river, and then downstream, a mile or two from that, people are using that same water as a drinking water source. So these are three of the agronomists that I worked with when I was in Haiti. And we tried to give them some ideas about composting and soil science and the best way that they can manage their soils. So we went there and we tried to set up some of these composting operations and really get them into the idea that this could be a valuable resource for them. We would have this material, have it broken down and degraded. We sieved this. The reason I put a little dashed line around that is that's actually the front cover of an oscillating fan. And that was the sieve that they had available to use. Okay. So this was sugar bag ash. And then we applied that by hand and got out there and did some good manual labor and constructed these plots. And we applied this compost at different rates. And we were looking at pepper production, whether it was jalapenos or cayennes or habaneros, different things that they could potentially use. I want you to realize that for people in this room, we go out and we do a production, you know, plot like this. That's common, right? I mean, we weigh things, we look at the biomass and all this. This was revolutionary to these guys that I was working with. They don't think in these terms. They just don't understand how to go about setting up a scientific experiment like this and trying to demonstrate to the villagers that, hey, if you put this much compost on the soil, you're going to get more production. If you don't put any on there, you're going to have far less production. So taking those kinds of concepts to them was remarkable. And this gives you an idea of what that compost contained. It moderated the pH. It was high in magnesium, phosphorus, potassium, a little bit more sodium, but also provided sulfur and zinc relative to their depleted silty clays that were naturally occurring there. So it was able to provide a wide range of nutritive value to the soils. Let's shift over to Romania in Eastern Europe. This is a country that I've worked in extensively when I was there for my Fulbright in 2011. GDP there is $17,000 per capita, and again, they joined NATO in 2004, the European Union in 2007. You see as you move throughout Romania a beautiful culture, a long-standing historical culture, and that is everywhere today. You can see it. It's like turning back the clock in many instances, decades. This is a mill that I was able to visit when I was up in the Apuseni Mountains, and what kind of sawmills do we have in the United States like this, where they're dragging the trees out of the forest to the mill with a horse? Okay, those are the kinds of things you see there. And again, this isn't some place on the far end of the earth. This is a member of the European Union. Okay, here they're using a hand-drawn well to collect water. And I should mention that this particular well at the Kovaci family, they can no longer use for drinking water because of nitrates that have worked their way into the water source. So they use it for irrigation, but not for human consumption. Romania is a place where you still see shepherds herding sheep everywhere, just roaming across the countryside. A lot of agriculture there is done by hand. You know, they do have some tractors and things like that, of course, but you see a lot of hay that is literally harvested with a scythe by hand and raked and piled. Okay, there it is, right there. You can see them out there cutting the hay in the countryside. So while I've been there, I've undertaken multiple studies. I looked at soil temperatures in the Transylvanian Plain, and really that led me to another study, which I've worked extensively with Dr. Laura Paulette on, concerning environmental quality assessment in towns that have been influenced or impacted by smelting activities of several decades ago. In Zlatna, Kopshamika, most recently last summer, we were in Baia-Mare looking at these metals. You'll see a lot of the laboratory facilities there in the process of being upgraded, but they still do a lot of wet chemistry in their laboratories. Back in 2006, I was at their OSPA, which is kind of the Romanian equivalent of NRCS, and these are the kinds of techniques they were using less than 10 years ago. And those kinds of things are gradually, being modernized, but it takes time, for a country to modernize itself. As we have some of the new European Union money flowing into Romania, they are starting to get the ICPs and the carbon nitrogen analyzers and those kinds of equipment, but there's this legacy of that equipment not being available to students to use. It's reserved just for faculty use. And so how are the students supposed to learn that stuff if they can't access that equipment and learn about it? Slowly they're going from paper maps. When I first started working in Romania in 2007, they would literally put these maps out on the hood of a car, and that's how they were drawing soil maps. And now we're starting to see more GIS technologies being integrated. So this is a real story of a country that's evolving, and it's been fun for me to watch that evolution. Dr. Paulette and I went out and we collected some monoliths. They had monoliths in their university, but those were 50 years old. And the people that were there had never even collected a monolith before. They didn't have that capability. So I'm going to pose some questions here to you. How do you convince an industry to clean up the environment after decades of use, neglect, and abandonment? This is a site that we went to in Zlatna where we did our spatial variability modeling of lead and cadmium and arsenic. Here in the U.S., this would probably be a Superfund site, right? We saw kids playing on that. It's not cordoned off. There's no fences anywhere. It's just available for people to just walk around, okay? So really amazing to see. How do you bring goods to market in Romania in a country that has one interstate highway throughout the entire country? Again, this is a modernization question. We want them to take the next step. They've got incredibly fertile soils there and parts of the Transylvanian Plain, but if we're still harvesting those crops by hand, we've got to ramp that up to more modern terms. In the United States, we've seen people, when you're farming on areas like this that are sloped, you put in terraces, right? And you'll notice I don't know where the mouse was here, but if you look very carefully here, you see that they're plowing up and down those hills there. So when they get heavy rains, the erosion just slumps right off, and they've got issues of some of these landslides occurring. Look at the differences between Hungary and Romania. These two photos, aerial photos, were only taken 20 miles apart. And you can see how the land parcels in Romania are totally different than the way they do agriculture in Hungary. Hungary is kind of the big traditional agronomy, the major companies are there, the John Deere tractors, all those kinds of things, whereas Romania, just across the border, you're looking at that agriculture that is, conducted in a different way. It really is. So when I go and I talk with the local villagers, how do you enter that country and work to alter long-standing cultural practices without offending its native population? Who am I to come in and tell Mr. Kovaci here, hey, you shouldn't be farming your land that way. Really, it would be better if you do it this way. I don't want to be that guy, even though I know the science tells me that, boy, we could manage that land in a more effective way. So you have to be very careful about the way you go in and approach these people. You have to approach them on their own terms and in a way that benefits the land but also doesn't offend. What about Alaska? Let's look closer to home here within our United States. We know permafrost-affected soils occupy large areas of the U.S. and worldwide, and they play critical roles in global carbon dynamics. But we also have extensive natural resource exploration there. As you look at the oil and gas deposits and the coal deposits, and we see all the oil production that's going on the North Slope, but also the fact that Shell decided not to drill up there for their most recent project, which was in the news recently. Of course, the Alaska pipeline, 2 million barrels, goes snakes all the way from Prudhoe Bay down to Valdez and really a remarkable engineering structure. You look at things across Alaska and you'll see that they have really, in some instances, I think very healthy views of the environment. They recognize the fact that forest fire there has been a natural part of the ecosystem for thousands of years. So they'll just let the forest burn. You know, here in the lower 48, we have a forest fire in California or Colorado, and boy, it's the first thing on the 5 o'clock news, you know, tragedy and all this. The fire was here long before the people were, really. Okay. This peat moss that they have up there, the sphagnum moss, is incredibly spongy. I don't know if we can, let's see if this will play, this video clip. Take a look at this. Okay. You think there's some carbon there? Yeah, a lot of carbon in Alaska, okay? And that's so important as we think about the amount of carbon that's being stored in those soils, sequestered out of the atmosphere, okay? These are organic soils, hemistels, okay? And they have variable degradation of these different levels of organic matter. We have permafrost below this as well that's helping to preserve some of that carbon and keep it out of the atmosphere. This is Sukakpak Mountain along the western edge of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where you've heard a lot about in the news, should we exploit those areas for oil production? Well, you know, we could do that, but it's one of the few last remaining truly wild places that have been unaffected by people. As you go farther up onto the north slope, you see this polygon soil formation with ice wedges and lenses and veins. These polygons are really unique. But you look at an area like this. This is along the Beaufort Sea. And you see that the influence that climate change is having on Alaska is dramatic. As this ice up underneath the permafrost layer here melts, the areas of soil above that, the active layer, slump off, as you see right here, and they fall right into the Beaufort Sea. And this is cutting back into the landscape here at a rate of about 15 feet per year, and that stretch is about 300 or 400 miles long. Okay, so just an incredible amount of degradation going on there. I thought so much of this that I have raised some money to do a documentary film on this. Might see some of these little cards around, but the documentary film that we're producing is called Between Earth and Sky, and it documents the influence of climate change on Arctic soils and ecosystems, and you can look for that in January of 2017. What about in South Africa? This last year, Dr. Moore Kusera and I went down there, and we looked at some of the mining activities and those influences that they have on soils. You see these large areas of strip mines that have gone on, and the scars that those have left behind on the land surface as they exploit coal, gold, diamonds, palladium, platinum, chromium. And they leave behind tailings and production water. These are what the landscapes look like down there. All of these photos were taken this last year, whether it's gypsum deposits or sludge or slurries or heavy metals left behind, salts, all kinds of accumulations. And it really seems to be that a lot of these companies decide to just kind of walk away from it and go down the road and continue on with the production of the next mine facility. And you see these all over the place down there. So how can these mineral resources be extracted with minimal anthropogenic impact? How will these mining companies be held accountable for this environmental degradation? The last time I checked the price of gold, it was pretty high. I think they're making some pretty good money. But will they be required to take that money and reinvest it in cleaning up the environment? That is a poignant question to me. Think about salt-impacted soils around the world. These aren't germane just to the United States. We see them in Romania. We see them in Africa. We see them all over the place. One of the points that I want to drive home to you today is something like salt-affected soils. When I study that, it's not a Texas issue. It's not a New Mexico issue. It's not a North American issue. It's a worldwide issue. There are no borders when it comes to scientific discovery and advancement. Okay, so you see these salt-impacted soils, whether they're saline or sodic, they've continued to increase. And this really poses a threat to our overall agricultural productivity. And these problems and challenges occur all over the world. This photo I took in Romania, close to a little town called Turda. And we know the influence of this, lowering the osmotic potential of the water, decreasing soil fertility, causing ion toxicity, crusting, etc. This was taken in Louisiana. in an area where they've had oil production occurring. And this was taken out in West Texas. So, you know, these kinds of things happen all over the place. You look out in eastern New Mexico, we've got gypsic soils out there. We've got gypsic soils in Spain, outside of Zaragoza, that look just like this. Okay? So these are the common threads that I want to leave you with. In my mind, education is key. These farmers in developing countries, often uneducated folk themselves, rely on historical precedent for their farming practices. Dad did it this way. Grandpa did it that way before him. And they might be skeptical of scientific or advanced agronomic approaches. We need to encourage these farmers and residents to understand the importance of long-term ecological sustainability, but you have to take the knowledge to them on their terms, in their communities, in their comfort zone, without being a threat. And realize that the results will be slow. I had a former student of mine who was in the Peace Corps, and she told me years ago, when we were working in Haiti, she said, you know, you have all these grand ideas of implementing the composting and do all that, and that's great. But take the idea of what you want to accomplish, that whole big ball of wax, and if you get 5% of that actually done, pat yourself on the back. Those are the kinds of daunting challenges you face in these emerging countries, okay? It's logistical issues, it's cultural issues, it's political issues, there's corruption that you have to fight. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, and it can be a really daunting task. You see some new ideas for old systems, whether they're agronomic measures, vegetative measures, structural measures, management, or a combination thereof. We live in a global community today. Issues here, issues everywhere. This technology transfer is key, but also with deference to societal acceptance. But we cannot afford to sit on the sidelines and wait for other people to solve these problems. So I encourage you to be the difference and encourage others to be as well. Thank you.